I want to welcome everyone to the first of the 2008 Grand Rounds. These are hospital-wide Grand Rounds, and we're going to have four this year, and everyone is invited. I hope that you'll attend. Announcements about the programs and the times and the dates will go out. Today is the first annual Dr. Michael E. DeVanke Lecture at the Methodist Hospital. For me, it is personally gratifying because several years ago, Dr. DeVanke rescued me and gave the first Methodist Grand Rounds, which was very well attended and very well received. He certainly deserves to have a named lectureship here at the hospital where he really transformed cardiac and vascular surgery in the 20th century. We have many people here today and many guests, but I would like to first ask Dr. Antonio Gatto, who is Dean of the Weill Medical School of Cornell and our primary medical school, to please say a few words. Dr. Gatto.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jackson. It's a great pleasure for me to be here and an honor to be asked to make some comments, which will be very brief. But Dr. DeVanke had a very strong influence on my career, was involved in recruiting me here from NIH when I almost went to Cornell at that time. And we had a strong, very close collaboration as well as friendship over the next 25 years while I was here at Baylor and Methodist Hospital. One looks over the last century and the contributions to medicine as a whole, even apart from surgery. I know of no one who has made the contributions that Dr. DeVanke has. He's been recognized all over the world and with very special recognition from our government and our Congress recently. So if one looks at what he's done from MASH units to the establishment of Medicare to the National Library of Medicine outside the field of surgery, it's truly remarkable. When I came and visited him 2 years ago in January and went to his home, he had an Annals of Surgery from 1962 or 63 open. And he said, I want to show you something here. This was my report of the first some 100-odd cases of what I've just diagnosed myself as having. So I know of no one who has developed a procedure, trained a student to do it, and had it carried out on himself. So this is another remarkable first. So, Mike, we all love you, admire you, and are delighted to be here to participate in this inaugural lecture. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bell. Dr. DeVanke, would you please say a few words? Let me put the microphone
on. Yeah, now it's on.
Yes.
Well, first, let me express my grateful appreciation for having my name associated with the lectureship. But more importantly, I want to say how pleased I am that this is being done, largely because it's a scholarly effort. And any scholarly effort that our staff participates in has an impact on the entire staff and on the quality of work that's going on in the institution. So I think we should all embrace any scholarly efforts we have, and one of them is lectureship. Another course is Grand Round and so on down the line. And it's all the more important to do that now since we don't have the support of Baylor College of Medicine. I'm glad to see Tony here, and I'm very hopeful that he will lend his support to his institution too. This first lecture is being given by George Noon, who was a long-time resident of ours. As a matter of fact, I picked out George when he was a medical student. And I can say that he was one of the best residents we ever had. Devoted and dedicated to his patients and to precise and accurate work. And in surgery, of course, preciseness and accuracy is important. I want to say I'm glad to see Dan Cooley here, because this lecture is going to review some of the innovative work in cardiovascular surgery. And without Denton, there would not have been any innovative work. He participated with me in every step of the way, and I would say the full initiation of, for example, surgery of the aorta, as well as in many other aspects. I'm proud to have been associated with him in doing all this. He was of tremendous help, and I'm proud to see him here. He will recall many of these events very deeply, because he participated in them. And that also is the reason that George should be able to do it very well, because he lived a good part of his residency in the developments that he's going to describe. So we can look forward to a good lectureship, and I'm hopeful that this will inaugurate a series of scholarly efforts on the part of the staff and the institution. Thank you very much.
Dr. Noon, of course, really needs no introduction, but I feel I must say a few words about him. He's a native of Nogales, Arizona, and attended medical school here at Baylor College of Medicine. Of course, he completed his residency training with Dr. DeBakey in general and thoracic surgery. And he and Dr. DeBakey have a very special relationship, as you know. Who else do you know has a relationship of being a mentor, professor, and student, then as colleagues and partners, and now recently as doctor and patient? Dr. Noon accompanied Dr. DeBakey to Russia in 1996 to be part of the team consulting for President Boris Yeltsin. He has performed the first implantations of the DeBakey ventricular assist devices in Europe and the United States. But something else which really speaks to George and his personality is that in 2002, he was chosen by the Methodist nurses and the staff here to receive the prestigious John W. Overstreet Award, which exemplifies the best of our medical profession. Dr. Noon's accomplishments and accolades really are too numerous to list at this time. But I think the greatest compliment is that when Dr. DeBakey agreed to have a lectureship in his name, he wanted Dr. Noon to give the inaugural lecture. So please welcome George.
Well, thank you, Dr. DeBakey, and thank all of you for being here for this inaugural lecture. As you know, Dr. DeBakey came to Houston, to Baylor, at that time University College of Medicine, back in about 1949. And when he came here, there were no residents or no postgraduate training at all. The local surgeons were sort of resistant to his presence and the goals that he was seeking to achieve. What he built and accomplished here, he did from scratch. DeBakey and his associates over the years created a mecca of cardiovascular surgery. Visitors came from all over the world and trainees to participate and see what was happening here in Houston, Texas, under the leadership of Dr. DeBakey. Surgery, research, and training flourished. DeBakey, along with Baylor College of Medicine, the Methodist Hospital, and Texas Medical Center, put Houston on the map. Over the years, he had a lot of surgical associates that worked with him, that helped him develop the things that I'll be talking about today and carry it on here in the future. Dr. Cooley, who's here, this, of course, is one of the outstanding ones that he had. Stanley Crawford, George Morris, Sam Henley, who's here. Ed Garrett, Jimmy Howell, Charlie McCollum, Ted Dietrich, myself, Hartwell Wisenan, Gerald Laurie. Had the help of George Jordan working in the laboratory on the vascular grafts, Arthur Bell, and others, to name a few, and Dr. Paul Jordan. Well, surgery of the vessels, as far as aneurysms, the first reported case was back in the 2nd century AD from a procedure of a proximal ligation of an antecubital artery and evacuation of contents after an arteriotomy. In the 19th century, the first report of a ligation of a ruptured iliofemoral aneurysm with a 40-hour survival was performed. In 1825 to 1899, a number of reported aneurysm surgeries in various locations. Dr. William Keene did aortic aneurysm ligation, partial ligation below the diaphragm with a survival of 48 days. At that time, the aneurysms were primarily treated by ligation. Dr. Cooper in 1817, ligation. Induction of thrombosis by inserting steel wires was used by Moore. Passing of electrical current within a vessel. Endoaneurysmography by Dr. Montes, who was from Tulane, where Dr. DeBakey was, before he came to Houston. Cellophane wrapping of the aneurysm in 1948. This is Dr. Rudolph Montes, who did the first successful double ligation of abdominal aorta at the bifurcation, with a patient surviving for 1 year and 5 months and succumbing later to tuberculosis. This is a diagram of the procedure that he performed in that patient. Albert Einstein had an aneurysm wrapped with a cellophane and lived for 5 years after his surgery. You can see Albert Einstein with his pipe as he was leaving the hospital, the Brooklyn Jewish Hospital, in 1949. The first modern repair of an aneurysm of abdominal aorta was done by Charles Dubose with a replacement in 1951. We had a retroperitoneal approach to replacement of the diseased aorta using freeze-dried thoracic aorta. Dr. DeBakey performed a successful resection of aneurysm and homograft replacement in 1952. 1953, successful resection and homograft replacement of aneurysm and descending thoracic aorta. 1956, successful repair of 4 thoracoabdominal aneurysms. This is Dr. DeBakey. This is when he first started thinking about surgery. This is Dr. DeBakey when he was at Tulane, and at that time, he went out for football and played football for a while, but after being on the scrub team, they whipped him and beat on him for a while. He decided he was going to stop football, and then he played was a handball player and was a championship handball player at Tulane. In the late 1930s, after his medical school, he went and spent some time in Europe, and this is at him with Strasbourg with Lariche, who was very active in the treatment of patients with occlusive disease. During World War II, he volunteered to serve in the United States Army, and after the war was over, he volunteered to spend extra time in the Army. And during that period of time, he was very influential in forming a MASH, or concept of MASH units. The National Library of Medicine was formed. Veterans Hospital idea was performed and succeeded in establishing. Also a registry of vascular surgery. This is the Library of Medicine in Washington, which he was very instrumental in developing and it flourishes today. Now, this is Baylor College of Medicine when he came in 1949. He was telling me that one of the times he was out in Baylor and he heard some shots and he went over to find out what it was, and it was a deer hunter hunting deer in the property. So you can see it was out there in the wilderness at that time. And this is Herman Hospital and the Herman Professional Center that are over here, Herman Hospital, the Professional Center, and Baylor College of Medicine. One of the persons who was helpful to him getting established in the Jefferson Davis Hospital was, and a very good friend of him was Ben Taub, as you see here. At the Methodist Hospital, this is Ted Bowen, who was very helpful. He came over from St. Louis. He was a forward-thinking and helped Dr. DeBakey in establishing, for example, when he got here, there was no intensive care unit. And so they were able to establish a four-bed intensive care unit, which later expanded. At that time, monitoring was not what it is today, and I can remember one time we walked into the intensive care unit. I saw a patient in the morning who, when I went up to examine the patient was cold, cold as ice. But the patient was on a respirator, and the chest was moving in and out, and had a nurse at his bedside. And I asked the nurse, I said, how's he doing? She said, well, he had a pretty quiet night. And I said, how's his blood pressure? She said, 120 over 80. I said, okay. Well, anyway, with the help of the two of them, Dr. DeBakey and Ted Bowen, were able to make great strides here at the Methodist Hospital over the years. This is myself when I was a resident back in 1960, little change between now and then. And this is what's happened to the medical center over the years. Well, this is a diagram of the first aneurysm that was replaced by DuBose back in 1952 using a homograph. One of the things about homographs here in Houston, Dr. Bakey was telling me that the coroner over at the Jefferson Davis Hospital was a little bit lazy and didn't like to do too many of the posts, so he gave Dr. DeBakey permission to do posts. And so in doing those posts, they were able to get the aorta and start their work and research using aortic homographs. And this is one of the early homographs that was used for replacement of infrarenal abdominal aortic aneurysm. Well, homographs were okay, but they really weren't the answer to the replacement of the aorta. They wanted something that would be that you could get off the shelf that would be more durable than the homographs, which would degenerate and become aneurysmal themselves. So various fabrics were used. Well, he went to the Foley's downtown to get some nylon to do some work with developing one of these grafts. Well, unfortunately, when he got down there, the clerk told him, well, we don't have any nylon. We're all out. But we have something new, polyester Dacron, that you can have instead of the nylon if you want. And he said, well, okay, we'll try that. So he got it, and that's where the polyester Dacron graft started. He was telling me that Dr. Schumacher, another one who was working on it, went to the store. He got nylon. He wasted 2 years working on the nylon. This shows some of the early grafts that were used, mandrels that they're formed on, and then eventually we use the crypt graft, as you see right here. This is an early Dacron graft that was placed, and this is a homograft and Dacron graft side by side used for replacement of infrarenal abdominal aortic aneurysm. These are what the aneurysm looks like. This is the infrarenal abdominal aortic aneurysm. You can see what it looks like when you remove it, open it up, look down it. And then we had CAT scans come along that you can see them like that. So they're just what we're seeing when we take out the aorta and examine it pathologically or in our hand. And so this is just, again, a Dacron graft using to replace an infrarenal abdominal aortic aneurysm. Aside from rupture, these aneurysms can also have emboli. And this shows the patient who has emboli in his lower extremities related to the aneurysm, and this is some necrotic toes related to emboli from the aneurysm. Is then from just going from the regular infrarenal to combined resection of aneurysms of infrarenal and iliac arteries, you can see here, infrarenal abdominal aortic aneurysm combined with revascularization related because of occlusive disease here of the renal arteries, the celiac arteries, and then down to the femoral arteries. So a combination of both aneurysmal and occlusive disease. Well, because of his work, he received the Albert Lasker Award for Clinical Research in 1963. The Albert Lasker Award was presented by Mary Lasker to Dr. DeBakey in 1963 for his brilliant discoveries, leadership, and professional accomplishments which were responsible in such a large measure to inaugurating a new era in cardiovascular surgery. This shows Mary Lasker and Dr. DeBakey receiving the award. Well, because of the work that they were doing here, the word about DeBakey and the medical center and what they're doing in cardiovascular surgery eventually brought over the Duke of Windsor for repair and replacement of his aneurysm of the infrarenal abdominal aorta. And as it says here, Dr. DeBakey was the maestro for the Duke of Windsor. In 1965, he was chosen by Time magazine as one of the 100 great Americans of the 20th century and honored for his pioneering work and innovations in cardiovascular surgery and the artificial heart. Dr. DeBakey was featured on the magazine's cover May 28, 1965. As far as working your way around the aorta, the initial patient here with an aneurysm of the ascending aorta, which is a saccular aneurysm, which could be treated by partial occlusion and replacement with a graft, and this was without cardiopulmonary bypass. When cardiopulmonary bypass was available, then we were able to do replacements of the ascending aorta, as you see here, utilizing cardiopulmonary bypass. Then there were multiple staged resections of aneurysms that you see here, where we did the ascending aorta, the abdominal aorta, and then the descending thoracic aorta. The arch, a very difficult area to operate on. And this is the initial operations that were done on the arch without cardiopulmonary bypass, and you can see they were able to establish the flow between the ascending aorta, the descending thoracic aorta, and then grafts up to the cerebral vessels, to the carotids. And after these aneurysms were resected and replaced, then you can see how the early bypass that was used for maintaining cerebral circulation and distal circulations were removed. Here's a patient that was seen 5 years after such an operation. Another one here, this was done with cardiopulmonary bypass. And another one here that shows the development of a false aneurysm 12 years after the operation. And then you see in 23 years later, the patient's still doing well. One of the things we learned about false aneurysms that in the early days, silk suture was used for suturing. This suture would disintegrate and patients would develop false aneurysms. And so Dacron suture, polypropylene sutures were then used to replace these for anastomoses in these patients. Another thing that was added to the arch is the elephant trunk, where you have a piece of graft that goes down into the descending thoracic aorta. So when you have to go back at a later date, you can open up the aorta and have a nice piece of graft to clamp to perform your distal operation. As far as the arch was concerned, there were things that have been done over the years to try and maintain cerebral circulation and viability during the period of the operation. And so cardiopulmonary bypass with antegrade perfusion of the brain was used and is still used. Circulatory arrest, where patients would be cooled down to about 15 degrees centigrade. They need to have circulatory arrest and then warm the patient up after the rest was not necessary when you were working on the ascending aorta and could perfuse the arch. Another thing that was developed was a retrograde cerebral perfusion that could be used during the period of circulatory arrest, where you would then perfuse oxygenated blood through the superior vena cava up to the brain. This just shows a patient who had segmental arterial disease with resection of an infrarenal and then later a descending thoracic aneurysm. And it shows the pump taking blood from the left atrium and pumping it into the femoral artery. Initially, these aneurysms were treated with just clamp, cut, and sew. And then later, we used this type of support to try and decrease the incidence of paralysis following this type of operation. Thoracoabdominal aneurysms were very difficult and extensive aneurysms to take care of. And you can see in this one on the arteriogram on the right that what we were using at that time was direct to translumbar aortograms to visualize these patients. And at that time, We were doing translumbar aortograms, our peripheral aneurysms, arteriograms were done with percutaneous carotid, subclavian, and femoral punctures in addition to the translumbar that we're doing. We weren't using catheters at that time. And these were done mostly under general anesthesia, turning the patients over. Our anesthesiologists would cringe today if they had to do one of these patients. Anyway, as you can see, they start out with bypass from the descending thoracic to the abdominal, and then bypasses to the visceral and to the renal vessels. And then over the years, the technique became modified, and you can see this patient here who had a aneurysm starting just distal to the left subclavian going down to the abdominal aorta, and now the attachment of the visceral vessels and the intercostal vessels was done using patches of aorta rather than individual grafts going to these vessels, which simplified the procedure. Then there was a classification of thoracic and abdominal aneurysms, which you can see here from 1 to 5, which was developed. And then we come to aneurysms of the dissecting type. And actually, when I was a medical student, it was Sam Henley and Dr. Bacon that were working on these development of the naming of these aneurysms, or sort of the types. I was working and doing research for them, and actually my senior paper in the medical school was covering descending thoracic or dissecting aneurysms, rather. And you can see the types here. There's the type 1 beginning in the ascending aorta and extending down to the abdominal aorta, and it can go down into the iliac vessels or further. The type 2, where the aneurysm is localized in the ascending aorta, and this is what Dr. DeBakey had developed when he had his problem. And then you can see the type 3 aneurysm here. And these aneurysms develop because of a rupture or a tear that occurs within the intima, and then the blood goes out between the intima and adventitia through the media and dissects around. And this just shows a pathological specimen of a dissection and a specimen that was removed, and you can see the hematoma within the wall of the aneurysm. So staging these, the most dangerous of these aneurysms is the ascending aorta. These are the ones that are most prone to rupture. So the type 1 aneurysms, we consider emergencies and operate on them and replace them as you see here. And then we follow the patients along. Many patients don't need any other procedures, but other patients end up requiring further procedures as you see here with replacement of problems within the descending thoracic, abdominal aorta, and the aortic arch. As far as the coronary arteries and those with the ascending aortic aneurysm, you can see the different techniques that we use in reestablishing coronary blood flow in these patients. And as we showed earlier, the descending thoracic aneurysm here being treated with with the atrial femoral bypass resection and anastomosis, as you see. One of the things as far as trying to decrease the incidence of paraplegia in these patients, we use a reanastomosis of the intercostal arteries, usually down in the 8, 9, 10 area, and usually with just a side-to-side anastomosis between the graft and the aorta. This one just shows some little grafts that are coming off of... They're coming off of the aortic graft to the intercostal arteries. This actually is an operation that we did on Jacuzzi, Mr. Jacuzzi, who had developed the Jacuzzi apparatus for his son, and ended up that he was paraplegic and needed it for himself. But this was Mr. Jacuzzi's operation. So as many of you saw in the New York Times, they say the man on the table devised the surgery, and you can see Dr. DeBakey here after his operative procedure. When Dr. DeBakey got sick, he was actually at home working in his library, and he developed pain and radiating up into the neck, and he thought that probably this was a dissecting aneurysm. It took us a few days before we were able to get him to the hospital to really make a diagnosis. But after we made the diagnosis, he had a commitment where he was going to talk to the Academy of Medicine and Engineering and Science of Texas. And so he said, I am going, nobody else is going to take my place, and I'm going to do it. I said, okay, You're the man. So we went there, and he gave his talk, mechanical circulatory assistance. Well, the next talk on the program is listed here, aortic aneurysms and dissections using genomics to unravel pathways of these fatal diseases. So I don't know what he was thinking when he saw that. Anyway, this shows a picture of his aneurysm when it was first diagnosed, and it was actually a type 2 aneurysm with a neural thrombus without evidence of dissection at that time, but it was 5.7 centimeters in size. And over a period of time, this is on the 23rd of January, that shows that there was an increase, and it got up to 66, and then it went up to 77 millimeters in size on February the 6th. At that time is when it actually showed that there was dissection with a flap, but it was still localized to the ascending aorta. And at that time is when we operated on him. And this just shows the size of the aneurysms on January 3rd when we first did his CT scan and what it was on the 9th of February, the day that he was operated on. And this just shows another view of the aneurysm and the operation that we performed. This is the aneurysm repair a year after his operation. And you can see there's no dissection in the descending thoracic aorta. It'll just localize to the ascending aorta. And that was done under profound hypothermia and circulatory arrest. Well, now comes a new era in the aortic surgery. Back in 1989, an Argentinian, Juan Perotti, performed an endograft placement in an aneurysm of the infrarenal abdominal aorta. And now the operating room for vascular surgeons has changed. We used to do arteriograms in the operating rooms. They were just primarily procedures that we had performed, and we wanted to check that there was a satisfactory anastomosis and runoff and things looked okay. So we would do intraoperative arteriograms where they just bring a single x-ray machine in there and we'd shoot it and take the x-ray. And now you can see that the operating rooms have changed for these procedures that are performed with catheters, endograft placements, stents, dilatations, etc. So we've got a new era in the treatment of patients with both the aneurysms and arterial occlusive disease. These just show some of the endovascular grafts that have been developed and how they're placed within this one here, infrarenal abdominal aorta. And you can see here the graft that is present going down to both common iliac arteries for the infrarenal abdominal aorta, and now extending grafts up into the descending thoracic aorta. And as you can see here, this one's going past the left subclavian vein, and they're getting into the arch, and sometime in the near future will be up into the ascending aorta. And this is just a patient here who had ascending aorta with this, a regular operative procedure, then endografts in the descending thoracic and in the infrarenal abdominal aorta. Well, as far as imaging, there's been changes in imaging which have made a significant difference. In the early days with the aneurysms, for example, this one of the infrarenal abdominal aorta, what we would look for was calcification in the aneurysm, and then we could make the diagnosis of the aneurysm. And we would also perform an intravenous pyelogram, but that's all we had, IVPs and calcium in the AP and lateral of the aneurysm. Then ultrasound came along, and we've got precise measuring of aneurysms and the extents of aneurysms and follow-up of aneurysms using the abdominal ultrasound. The CAT scans for imaging, the use of IVUS for intraluminal visualization of aneurysms or occlusive disease in these patients, and the MRIs. This is a 3D CT scan showing aneurysms. So the advances that they're making in the endovascular and in the imaging of aneurysms and occlusive disease of the arterial system are just unbelievable. They can take you through the vessels with a tour from the inside of the vessel so that you can see exactly where areas of narrowing or aneurysm are performed. This is another post-operative 3D remodeling of a descending thoracic aorta. So this is, they mentioned that we had gone to Russia to see and help in the care of Yeltsin. And one of the things about the influence of Dr. Debakey is when we were there, anytime they wanted Yeltsin to do something, they came to Dr. Debakey. They said, Dr. Debakey, you better go talk to him, and this is what we want done. And so Dr. Debakey go in there and talk to him, and that's what was done. So that worked out fine. He was the only one that had any influence over Yeltsin. Well, one night we went to the house of the Minister of Health, and he had a pool table down in his basement. One thing when we were upstairs where they were having the meals, all of a sudden a lot of these surgeons that were there would disappear. And ended up that some of them were coming down to play pool, the rest of them were going outside to smoke. Then they'd come back in. Well, anyway, Dr. Debakey went around and went downstairs and saw him playing pool. He stood there for a minute, and they said, well, we better be nice. We'll ask Dr. Debakey if he wants to play. So Dr. Debakey said, well, okay, I'll play with you. Well, it ends up that, as they say in Texas, Dr. Debakey kicked their ass. And then finding out from Dr. Debakey when he was growing up, his father had a pool table in the house to keep he and his brother in tow. His brother and he were both excellent pool players. In fact, he said his brother was a little bit better than he was. But anyway, they had a good time playing that. So this is something that was very exciting for Dr. Debakey, and he was very happy to receive this. Just recently was the Congressional Gold Medal of Honor for all the achievements that he has had within his career in medicine and in surgery. And this is something that he's very proud of. So basically, that's all I've got to say. Thank you very much.
Stay up here for questions. Yeah.
We've got about 15 minutes for questions from the audience. I can't believe it. You all are mute? What about your consent forms early on for surgery of the aorta?
Well, the consent forms were, the patients were informed of what the operative procedures were. The consent forms aren't like they are today. And a lot of the achievements that were made in the early days would be very difficult to do today because of the IRB, FDA, et cetera. So like Dr. Debakey said, I was the IRB. So he was able to, to do things that today would take millions of dollars. For example, the first left ventricular assist device that he put in for recovery in this patient from Mexico, he was able to do with, of course, developing it in the laboratories and knowing that he had confidence that the device would work. But to do that same thing today would have been impossible. So, as far as the informed consent, all patients did or were given the information regarding their operative procedures, but it wasn't as extensive as it is as far as the forms that they have to fill out. And same with for example, the Dacron grafts. It takes years to develop grafts and have them tested and go through all the rigmarole to be approved, where he would be able to do that and get his graft in and try it out. And of course, they were all tested in the laboratory and research labs. But when they were ready and he felt they were ready, then they could go ahead and do that. Same with valves that they put in, the aortic valves, mitral valves, that today you would never be able to do that. It's just a different era that we're working in right now. But it was exciting working with Dr. Cooley, Dr. Debakey, and the rest of all these associates. Yeah.
Dr. Debakey had a role in the development of the roller pump.
Right. So the roller pump, which is a standard part of the cardiopulmonary bypass, was developed by Dr. Debakey when he was a medical student in about, was 1934, right in that time. And it was developed as a tool to give transfusions from one patient
from the donor to the patient. So they would use the roller pump to pump the blood. In fact, was it in Germany when you were in Heidelberg, they had you ahead of the transfusion service, and you were having to be pumping, using your roller pump all the time over there. But anyway, that's when it was developed for blood transfusions from one donor to the patient. And then, of course, later it was in cardiopulmonary bypass, and is a standard part of cardiopulmonary bypass today.
That's a great talk, George. Would you comment on those busy years, on the size of the service, the number of floors you went to, the number of operations at this hospital and in the Texas Medical Center on any given one day during those peak years, and how many hours sleep you got? And could you, as a resident, have done that with the 80-hour work rule?
As far as the 80-hour work week, I think the first 80 hours of the week would be... No, we couldn't have done it with the 80-hour work week. There's no way that we could have done that. And of course, as far as the operating rooms, one of the things is that we started out in the main Methodist Hospital. That was before there was a Brown Fauna, and that was before there was a Dunn. And so you had four operating rooms that you started out with, and then those later were expanded to the 10 operating rooms that are in the Brown Fauna building. Yeah, and initially, Dr. Baker was telling me that the Brown Fauna building, they were thinking of doing it for the orthopedic service with Joe King, but they were able to get it changed around so that the Browns and the Fondrens were supportive of building the Brown Fauna building, and that's where that came from. And so we moved from four to 10 operating rooms. And of course, those rooms were filled up every day with multiple operations, as they were with Dr. Cooley over at the Texas Heart and St. Luke's Hospital. As far as the number of patients in the hospital, there were times where there were more than 100 patients in the hospital. In fact, for years, there were more than 100 patients in the hospital. And as residents, we lived in the hospital for 3 months. And we would split it up between the floor or and the intensive care unit during that 3 months period of time. I can remember when I was in the emergency room with one of the other residents that was going to be starting over on Dr. Bakey's service. And both of us were in the emergency room running it together. Well, the tradition at that time was when they were going to go over to his service, they had to get over there at least a week ahead of time so that they could learn the service, so he wouldn't have to take care of any transitions from one resident group to another. So that left me alone in the emergency room over there at Jefferson Davis Hospital for a week all by myself while this guy was over there learning for Dr. Bakey. I think my 80-hour week was over, and so I was over at the end of the week, too. I think I'd had it all I could take. But anyway, it was very busy. And, of course, you know, one of the things that we have an advantage with today is our imaging. And that in those days, of course, all imaging was on regular X-ray film. And so one of the things that had to be ready for Dr. Bakey was all the x-rays. And so hunting the x-rays down, getting them up to the office, and getting them all in order was a real problem. Well, now, you know, with a radiologist, the way they are, they can sit down and flip from one thing to another, show you all the comparisons of, you know, throughout the years when these patients have been studied. It's much easier than it was at that time, at least for us. If we were residents, it would be, it was really difficult.
Describe how you prepared for the rounds every day.
Well, I mean, preparing for the rounds was just getting everything ready that needed to be ready, which was the x-rays, the list of, you know, where the patients were, so everything was, you know, would be organized so that when it was time for rounds, there was nothing that was missing. And of course, you can tell from Dr. Bakey what he's accomplished, that his schedules had to be precise, and And one of the things, he's very organized in what he does. And anything that interfered with his organization, you would be prepared to catch hell, because it was not something that he could tolerate. So you had to be ready and get with it and have everything in order so that you wouldn't be wasting any of his time. Isn't that right? I don't know if I want to let you make a comment or not.
It's in your
Yeah.
I just want to make a little comment about luck. George referred to the luck we had with Daquan. I'll just give you another illustration, because luck does play, if you want to call it luck, I'd rather call it providence. When I got married with my present wife, it was in August in Germany, and King Leopold and Princess Lillian were invited to the wedding. Well, she called up about 2 days before the wedding and said that she didn't think they were going to make it. They were in the south of France. They had a place down there, beautiful place, and because he was ailing, she didn't know exactly what was causing his trouble. In spite of the fact that he'd been seen by three doctors, one from Nice and one from Belgium and one from Paris. Well, and she asked me why we were going to have our honeymoon. It so happened on that same day, the man who had promised us a yacht for our honeymoon called up and said the yacht was in dry dock, that he would try to get us another yacht. Well, we decided we didn't want to do that. So we were up in the air about our honeymoon. And when she asked me where we were going to be, I told her the story. And she said, well, why don't you come down here in the south of France? Well, you know, this was August. I didn't think we had a chance to get a room. But she said she'd get a room for us, and she did. So we went down there. And next morning, she had a car sent for us, and we were sitting around her pool having a drink. And when we got up to go, I noticed he was limping. So I said, well, what did the doctor say? Well, they said he had lumbago. I said, it doesn't look like it to me. Let's go in your room and let me look at you. So we went in his room, and as soon as he exposed his abdomen, I could make a diagnosis by looking at it. He had a huge aneurysm of the abdominal aorta. And, you know, I made it clear to them that this was a very dangerous thing. And since he needed to be operated on right away. Well, there wasn't no place I could operate on him down south of France. So I said, you know, we need to fly him to Houston right now. So she arranged to get a flight out of the Belgian Airlines. They came and picked us up that evening, and we flew to Houston the next morning. They met us at the airport, and I took him to the operating room and operated him. And it was leaking. Now, he probably didn't have more than 12 hours or he'd have died. Well, you know, it seems to me that you got to explain why, how this happened. If it hadn't been for the fact that this man with the yacht, you know, told us he wasn't going to be able to, we would have gone. And he died. I never seen him. So this is another example of providence, how the role it plays in your life. And all through, you know, the career, there are examples of how providence played a role in your life. Look at the coronary bypass we did. You know, the coronary bypass was done at Hopkins 2 or 3 years before we did ours. But providence didn't smile on him. His patient died 2 or 3 days later. And as you know, a dead patient doesn't impress people. So we were lucky. I survived and did fine. And again, providence plays a role in that. So it just goes to show it's sometimes desirable to be grateful for the smiling of providence on what you're doing.
Yeah.
First time, George, very much at George's presentation, and of course, it brought back many memories for me. How long ago I was at a meeting such as this, somebody got up in the back of the room and said, Dr. Cooley, you spent your entire life in Houston. I thought, well, man, I said, not yet. I can recall my first interview with Dr. Baker. I met him about 1946 at the Southern Surgical up in Hot Springs, Virginia, when he was still in the service. Yeah, but when I came to Houston, back to Houston after I finished my training at Johns Hopkins, I went over to talk with Dr. DeBakey and see if I might have an opportunity at Baylor University College of Medicine. And he said, well, what other opportunities do you have? And I said, I had a chance to go to London with a registrarship with Mr. Russell Brock, who was an outstanding cardiovascular surgeon in London at the time. So when I came back to Houston in 1951, Dr. DeBakey was gracious enough to give me an academic appointment as an instructor in surgery. And I learned a great deal from that day forward from Dr. DeBakey. The only other person in our staff at the time was Oscar Creech, whom you remember very well and fondly. But the three of us were very much involved in vascular surgery and also in cardiac surgery. When George talks about the diagnostic facilities which were available to us at the time, as I look back on it, I think maybe our slogan should have been, ready, fire, aim. Because so often we went into the operating room without much idea of what we're going to encounter, as opposed to today, after you have all these imaging techniques and so forth, the surgeon is very comfortable, partly comfortable anyway, and knowing just what the anatomy is and a lot about the physiology and things that, we did not know about. But George, let me compliment you on being the first lecturer with Dr. DeBakey's lectureship, and thank you all for being here. I want you to know how satisfied and gratified and happy I am that we've had this recent reconciliation. We should never have separated in the first place, but now that we're all back together again with the same purpose, is promote medical science and to promote our Texas Medical Center. Thank you very much.
Godspeed to everyone.